KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What defines us? What determines our identity? Jennifer Ouellette explores how eye color, likes and dislikes, and even hatred of cilantro construct our individual identities. She underwent personality tests and genome sequencing to determine the slight variations that set us all apart. Ouellette is a blogger for Scientific American and the author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She spoke at Town Hall on February 25th, 2014.
Thank you for that very gracious introduction. Thank you all for coming out. It's a little blinding here up here, but hello. I actually grew up in Seattle, so this is kind of my home turf, and I'm delighted to be here with you all. How does a physics writer come to write a book about the science of self? These are areas that I don't normally cover, and it's two-pronged, really. One, when I wrote a book on calculus called The Calculus Diaries, I was an English major and kind of math phobic. I had always just assumed I was bad at math, and it became a huge part of my personal identity in the story that I told about myself to people. Oh, I was an English major, I suck at math, I hate it, the very sight of an equation makes me go squee. But when I went back, when I was writing the book, I went back to my high school transcripts. And lo and behold, I found that I actually got A's in mathematics, which means that I must not have been that bad at math. So where did this story of myself come from? That's a really interesting question. That's a huge part of personal identity. How we think about ourselves dictates the choices that we make and what we think we can and cannot do. The other fragment of this is that I'm adopted. My parents are here tonight, and my sister, all of whom feature prominently in the book. So the question of nature versus nurture was always very central to me. When you grow up with a family where maybe you don't have a direct genetic connection to them, you don't necessarily look like them physically, but you nevertheless have a very, very strong bond there, you start to wonder what part of me came from them and what part of me is just some weird genetic thing that has nothing to do with them. You know, how does that happen? And somehow these two prongs come together to form a coherent self. The problem when I started writing the book, of course, is how do you even define self? It's actually harder than it looks. I thought, oh, it's really easy. It's yourself. It's like defining truth or irony. So what I'm going to do is kind of take you through a whirlwind tour of some of the science. And I think of the self as kind of like an onion. We're going to start out with some really basic, superficial kind of things and just slowly peel back the layers until we get down to like the core of what we're talking about here. So, let's just say that a friend sets you up on a blind date. We all remember what this was like. Some of us still remember what this was like. What's the first thing that you do in this day and age? You're going to go right to Google. At least I am. Even if I just meet somebody that I think is kind of interesting, I'm going to Google and I'm going to figure out who they are, see if there's anything online that will give me a clue as to what they're like. I can find them on Facebook. I can read their Twitter feed. And if they have a blog, as I do, I can read their blog and get a sense even more of who they are because hopefully they'll write something a little bit longer and something of their personality will seep through. This is what we do whenever we meet new people. Psychologists call these schemas. And what we do is we start to piece together a schema for each person that we meet. We also do it for ourselves. And we flesh that out as we get to know a person better and more details emerge. And gradually we get a very rich, complex picture of who this person is. And we use that to predict their behavior and how we expect them to act in certain situations. And we get very, very upset when they don't act how we expect them to in certain situations. I actually met my husband through our blogs. It was one of those things where I started a physics blog, and he welcomed me to the blogosphere. We started emailing back and forth. I thought his posts were very charming and humorous and self-deprecating, and he was very smart. He is a PhD physicist. And so after a while, we arranged to meet. But I never would have even taken that next step if I hadn't gotten some clue about who he was based on that. Some people are a little skeptical that you can actually figure out what a person is like from their Facebook page. I once had a person get very upset with me when I told him that, you know, when I get friend requests from people, I will actually, and I don't know them, I haven't met them, I will actually go to their profile page and try to see, you know, what are their likes and dislikes, are there any clues there that they might be obnoxious, you know, because I'm very protective. I have close friends and family who interact with me on Facebook, and I'm protective of them. I don't want to expose them to people who will be rude to them or pick fights or otherwise just make things unpleasant for people. And it turns out that your Facebook page is what's, it's just one giant identity claim. If you think about it, it is all about how you choose to present yourself. You pick everything. You pick your cover photo. You pick your selfie that you use as your little icon there. You choose which likes and dislikes you have. You take little Facebook quizzes to tell you which member of Game of Thrones you're most like. I got Daenerys Targaryen once and then Jaime Lannister the other time. Does not bode well for me. So you really can get a sense of some very basic attributes of people by looking at their Facebook page. It's not comprehensive by any means, but it will let you know if there are any red flags there, if there's anything there that just automatically makes you incompatible. I'm also active in Second Life to a rather small degree. I host a program called Virtually Speaking Science. The Exploratorium in San Francisco co-hosts it in their Second Life space. That's my avatar, Jean-Luc Picant, my husband's avatar. And what I basically do is every second Wednesday of the month, I have a scientist guest. They build their own little avatar, and we talk for an hour with them about their science, about their thoughts on science communication, about life in general. They tell funny stories. We learn about their research. It's a really wonderful hour-long, in-depth conversation, and it ends up as a podcast on Blog Talk Radio. This fascinated me, though, because I actually really enjoyed building my avatar, and I felt really guilty about it. I was like, God, am I really that big of a narcissist? But there is a certain wish fulfillment thing there. Your avatar can be whatever you want it to be. Most of us, I think, have some aspect of ourselves, physically or otherwise, that we do not like. Perhaps we feel that our physical appearance doesn't really reflect who we are inside. In Second Life, your avatar can look however you want. It can bear some resemblance to you. Mine only bears a passing resemblance to me. I've got this big athletic Norwegian build, and I always wanted to be gamine, so I made my avatar this big praying mantis kind of thing. Jan 11, the astrophysicist, decided that she just wanted to be a unicorn in a little punk rock dress. We had to remind her to put the dress on, because when she chose the unicorn, it didn't occur to her that she was technically naked. Maria Konnikova, who's the author of a wonderful book called Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, she just looks like herself. I mean, she really did kind of come up with something that truly represented who she was in the virtual space. The roboticist Malcolm MacGyver went all steampunk. And my personal favorite, Simon DeDeo, he works in complex systems and emergent theory. He chose to portray himself as a swarm of butterflies. Not even a human being, but he felt that that really captured his essence in a really fundamental way, and that is us dancing in Second Life. So avatars, in a very, very real sense, are one way that we extend ourselves beyond the physical realm, and they really do represent us in this online world. You'll have to excuse, I'm going to cough a little bit every now and then. I'm getting over a cold. So I mentioned that I met my husband technically online. I've also made many, many friends online. You just gradually get to know each other, and over time you take that big step. You meet in real life, in the meet world. And you have that fateful first date. And that's, if you really only know each other online, that making that transition can be a little awkward. And essentially what you're basically doing is sitting across and saying, so, tell me about yourself. And what do? You want to make it as natural as possible. You tend to tell stories. You tend to tell them a little bit about where you're from, what you do, what your interests are, maybe a funny story from that day. But what if it was easier? What if you could find a way to short-circuit that and just basically hand them a dossier of what science can tell them about yourself? What would you do? And this was kind of what I wanted to find out when I wrote the book, and I took all these various tests. And so we're going to walk through those. First of all, there's the matchmaking model. Personality testing, personality typing. This is basically centuries old, if not millennia old. I mean, if you go just right back to the astrological zodiac and your star sign, that really is basically a system of trying to typify people, trying to make sense of people, the differences between us, by trying to find common ground and patterns among people. In this case, when you're born, and what position the stars are in when you're born. In the 1900s, you had something called phrenology, which was, people actually thought that you could feel someone's head and there would be various lumps and they would give you a clue as to whether they were greedy or amoral. My personal favorite was apparently there's a little thing at the base of the back that you're lustful. Francis Gall, the guy who discovered it, claims that he discovered that when, you know, a lusty widow accidentally fainted in his arms and he felt that little knob at the back of her head, and he assumed that that had to have to do with her sexual desire. Now, that, of course, did not last into the 20th century because, of course, it's ridiculous that you could tell, you know, what someone, you know, what their self-esteem is like by feeling their head. In medieval times, we also had the medieval humors. But there is this sense, you know, that, you know, our brain is important. And I think that they were trying to get to this idea of the role the brain plays in personality. They just sort of phrase it as a personality test. Today, we are not immune to this at all. How many people have taken the Myers-Briggs test? Come on, all of you, right? Quite a few of you. I've taken it. I took it once in my 20s. I took it again for this test. It's a really interesting story. It actually originates with Carl Jung. When he had a falling out with his mentor, Sigmund Freud, he was kind of devastated. They had this really brief, tempestuous bromance, intellectual bromance, and then they had a falling out, largely because of their philosophical differences about the field of psychology, but also because they were very temperamentally different. And that got Jung interested in finding out, well, maybe I could categorize people and this would help me in the future, so that maybe I wouldn't have these falling outs because I would understand that other person a little better. And so he came up with three categories, you know, introversion, extroversion, thinking versus feeling, judging, all of those things that we know all well love, on that little circle there. And he published a book. It came to the attention of a mother-daughter pair, Catherine Briggs and her daughter Isabel Myers. They were both remarkable women. This was the 1920s, when Catherine Briggs was a young woman, and she went to college at the age of 14. This was an era when almost no women went to college. She obviously came from money, and her family could afford to send her, but even then it was very, very rare. Her daughter was equally precocious, published her first short story at 14. So they both became interested in Jung's archetypes for personality, to the point where Isabel decided that she could design her own test. And she threw herself into the task, and she added a fourth category, and she developed the Myers-Briggs type indicator. And, you know, it's not, you know, it gets a lot of criticism, because it's actually not, you know, a perfect indicator. If any of you have taken the test more than once, you'll know that you don't always get the same result. I think that I became far more extroverted over the years. I was very shy when I was younger. I also was more of a feeler, and now I'm more of a thinker, probably a result of writing about science for so long. So we do change. Personality really isn't as simple as a set fixed category. It's more of a continuum, and that means that it's actually very hard to predict what a person will do in any given situation, although you can figure out what they are most likely to do if you observe them over a long period of time. So I actually like the Myers-Briggs type indicator, but I don't think you should use it for really set predictions. You shouldn't use it to pick your girlfriend or boyfriend, to pick what kind of employees you should hire. It's not good for that. So it's probably also not going to help you much with your brain, with your date, because he can tell you he is an INFJ, but all that's really going to tell you is a few basic personality traits. And let's face it, the Myers-Briggs is entirely self-reported. He could have lied or been wrong. So let's really go, like, you know, that's very subjective. Let's go right to what's, you know, something really objective, a brain scan. If the brain is the seat of personality, if the self resides somewhere in the brain, surely we can take a picture of it, and then we will know what we are like. So I went and I had an fMRI done in the lab of David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist in Houston. You may have read his book, Incognito. He's a very colorful man. He's the guy who wanted to test. He became fascinated by the question of, does time really seem to slow down when you're terrified? So he got people to volunteer at Six Flags, and he threw them off a free fall. He had chronometers attached to their wrist, and he basically just asked them to measure the time and see if that was really true. Whether they felt time slow down, but in fact it hadn't. It was really just a perceptual thing. I wanted to be part of that experiment so badly. Instead, I got stuck sitting in an MRI machine, you know, pressing a little button in response to certain images. I have no idea what they were testing. The study is still going on. It turns out that science does not care about my book deadlines. I kept emailing David going, please, please, can you tell me what the study was about now? You know, I think it had something to do with religious preference and empathy. based on some of the control questions, but I don't know. The problem is, even though you get a very nice picture of the brain from all of that, this is not actually my brain, but my brain ended up looking something very much like that, it doesn't actually tell you very much. You know, how many people have heard that, you know, the fMRI basically lights up and shows you the brain in action? That's actually not what's going on in an fMRI. Certainly, it's an interpretation of raw statistical data. Normally, you just have a column of numbers. What you basically do is have a whole bunch of people. They're all taking the same test. You record all their responses. You dump all that into a computer. Then you chart it out to see where they overlap. And then you try and pinpoint those areas where people are all responding together. You figure that's something that's universal across the population. And those are the areas that, quote unquote, light up. They color code those in the scans and in the final images. It's a very pretty picture. It's fun to look at a picture of your brain. But about all it can really tell you is that you do not have a brain tumor and that you have very clear sinuses. I asked him that because I was allowed to kind of take a tour of my brain on his huge computer screen. You basically move the cursor and it would blow up one part of the brain. And I went over to this one big blob and said, "What's this like blank spot here?" He goes, "Those are your sinuses. It's not part of your brain." You know, he says, "They're nice and clear." And I said, "Well, can you tell when someone has a cold?" He goes, "Oh, yeah." He goes, "We had one guy come in here with really bad allergies, and you could just see the mucus just packed in there." So, yeah. The other thing you have to be careful about with fMRI is false positives. Has anybody here heard of the dead salmon paper? This is actually a very funny story. A couple of neuroscience grad students were basically told to calibrate the fMRI machine. Normally this is done putting in a pumpkin or a balloon filled with mineral oil. You want to just make sure it's reading things correctly. So they decided, just for fun, because they were bored and they're grad students, they'd put lots of different things in there and try and see how it changed. They put like a baseball and these various things, and they said, "I know, what about a salmon? We'll put a dead fish in there." So he went and he got a full salmon. He got up really early one morning, went to the fish market, got this big salmon, stuck it in the fMRI machine, and they asked it questions, you asked it to respond, you know, to certain visual stimuli. The thing is, when they did, you know, there should have been nothing there, but when they actually did the analysis, it lit up. Okay, that's a dead fish. there is no brain activity there whatsoever. That is a false positive. And a lot of people like to point to that to say, look, fMRI is useless and ridiculous. That's actually not what it tells you. It tells you that you need to do an extra amount of statistical analysis to basically account for false positives. But it was actually, it was just a grad student lark. He presented it as a poster session at a meeting. It turned out being a rather important paper in terms of improving the methodology. So, you know, go grad students.
Jennifer Ouellette, the author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She spoke at Town Hall on February 25th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Jennifer Ouellette in a moment, 924, 94.9, KUOW. Rebecca Neuberger is a philosopher and novelist and recipient of the so-called Genius Grant. That is, she's a MacArthur Award Fellow. In her novel, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, Rebecca asks, what if the Greek philosopher Plato came back to Earth in 2014 on an author book tour? Hear her talk about the book tomorrow in the noon hour. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 30s, partly cloudy, isolated showers this evening. Friday's outlook, highs near 50, mostly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows in the 30s, partly cloudy. Saturday highs, lower to mid-50s, but mostly cloudy and a chance of rain.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth ages 10 to 20 to participate in a study of a new smartphone app in a guided weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Why do some people like cilantro and others can't stand the taste of it? Science blogger Jennifer Ouellette underwent personality tests and genome sequencing to determine the mysteries of human identity. Her new book is called Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She spoke at Town Hall on February 25th, 2014.
Now, there is another possibility. Joseph Ledoux, about 10 or 11 years ago, he's an NYU neuroscientist, came up with this notion of the synaptic self. You are your synapses. You're not necessarily the parts of your brain. It's how your individual neurons are connected and communicate with each other. You all know that your brain gets wired all throughout life, and it constantly wires and rewires itself. It builds these connections and these synapses in response to your experiences, you know, your memories, all of these things. And those things become richer and more layered as you age, and you end up with this very fully developed, complex, cogitating human being. The problem is that there's a lot of those connections. We would love to be able to map this. It's called the connectome, genome connectome. You kind of get the gist there. It would give you essentially a map of every single connection in your brain at any given time. We simply do not have the computational capacity to do that. If you just wanted to do this for the roundworm, it would take like 50 years. And the roundworm only has 302 neurons, and we have like a billion, like billions. So, but it would look very pretty. But it's an interesting idea, and there isn't. It is part of the Brain Initiative that is being funded right now. The connectome research is a very, very big part of that. We thought that we would unlock the secrets of genetics when we mapped the genome, and that really didn't happen. It ended up being much more complicated. I'll talk about that next. But it's still useful to have mapped the genome because now we kind of at least know where we are as we start to explore. So this is the next step in terms of brain science. We would like to be able to understand, because that really does seem to be the essence of who we are, at least according to neuroscience as we understand it today. And bear in mind, of course, that neuroscience is still a very, very young field. It's like 150 years old. When I talk to Pat Churchland, the neurophilosopher, she says, you know, we're actually pre-Newton, pre-Kepler. We've barely sussed out that there are moons around Jupiter. We're that young. So very exciting time to be a neuroscientist. So final option, let's just, you know, just hand your data copy your genotype results. I had my results done with 23andMe. As an adopted child, I was actually very interested in this. I had actually met the founder, Anna Wojcicki, at a conference somewhere, and she said, absolutely, as an adopted child, you should do this. Among other things, you know, you can find your ethnic heritage. For me, what was most interesting, of course, was not so much my traits, because I kind of know who I am at this point. But anyone who's adopted out there knows that whenever you go to the doctor, they ask you for your medical history. And what can I say? I can tell them my mother's medical history, but since we're not genetically related, that's not going to be very helpful. So I spent a lifetime just kind of going to have to leave that blank. So I thought that this would be really, really interesting. And it did, in fact, verify a lot of interesting things. You know, I am, in fact, half Norwegian. You know, I can blame them for my broad shoulders. There's a reason that I have wet earwax as opposed to dry earwax. There's a reason that I love cilantro and don't like broccoli. I'm one of those super tasters that's really sensitive to bitterness. The health risks are a little bit less helpful. I don't know if any of you have followed in the news. 23andMe is actually in the midst of a feud with the FDA. They were actually forced to stop selling their diagnostic kits for a brief period. Debate is whether identifying health risks based on your genotype constitutes diagnosis. And that's it's a regulatory issue. I think that that's what they basically do at 23andMe is not tell you, here is your gene for X, and that means that you're going to get this disease. That's not how most diseases work. There's only one or two diseases that work that way. Huntington's is one of them. There is one specific genetic variation for Huntington's. If you have that, you are going to die of Huntington's. It's a matter of when, not if. But most of the time, it doesn't work like that. There are risk factors. And I personally found that 23andMe was very responsible about that. They would give you the statistical probabilities, they would show you the background, they would link you to the relevant research papers, they would let you know whether it was a kind of iffy preliminary study or whether it was a really robust study that had been done with like lots of subjects and things like that, had really stood the test of time. I don't know what else you can do, but it's between them and the FDA, and they've got to work that out. These kinds of questions are going to become more and more relevant, and we might as well start struggling with them now and figure out how we're going to handle policy, because this the day is not long far. It's already, you can get this done for like $99. You can get your full genome for about $1,000. The day when each and every one of us will be having our genotype done as a matter of course is not that far off. We had better start thinking about some of the legal ramifications. So I'm actually kind of glad that there's this head-to-head going. So let's say that I give you a copy of my genotype result and you're going through the results and you say, whoa, wait a minute. What is this slightly increased risk of alcoholism? And then you look at me downing my glass of wine and thinking, am I going to have to, like, you know, carry her home? You know, so I can't. It's an interesting question. I am, in fact, a pathetic lightweight. But my genotype did show me that I have a slightly elevated risk for alcoholism. Again, we had this notion that there's this one gene, one trait model, and that's not really how it works. It's not Mendel's pea plants. There's several genes that are involved in this. There's also brain aspects of the brain that are involved in this, cultural conditioning, psychological traits. All of these things kind of add together, and if you hit a certain threshold, you know, a certain percentage of the population is more prone to developing alcoholism. There are 23andMe really only tests for three genetic variants. One only applies to men. One only applies to Ashkenazi Jews, and I'm neither of those. And the other one was just one. If you have two copies, you're at a high risk. I only had one rather than two copies, so nothing to worry about. Like I said, genes are deterministic, but they're not destiny, and nowhere is this more clear than when we're talking about something like alcoholism, because that's a behavior. It's a disease that is identified by behavior. Behaviors are not traits. You cannot look at how someone behaves and then say, tell me the gene that's responsible for that, because it's very, very complicated. Genes may be responsible for certain personality traits. They're certainly responsible for height. But even for height, which is very easily identified, it's 80%, 90% heritable. There are something like 15, 20 genes that help determine how tall you are, all working together. And it's even more complicated for something like alcoholism. So this whole notion of one gene, one trait, you know, the pea plants that we all learned in grade school, it doesn't actually apply to this. So my date need not have worried. It turns out that I am a cheap date. I call it that because there's a woman named Ulrike Heberlein, and what she does is she is a geneticist, behavioral geneticist, and she gets fruit flies drunk for a living, puts them in this little contraption called an inebriometer. It's filled with ethanol vapor. I'm not kidding. This is actually what she calls it. I visited her lab. This is what I saw. And they're hilarious. Essentially, she measures how long it takes them to pass out. And she does it over and over again to see if their tolerance increases. And what she's done is she knocks out a specific gene and sees how that affects it. It turns out there's a gene that she nicknamed cheap date that if you knock that out, they become lightweights. And they pass out much, much faster and they do not build up a tolerance. And apparently that is me. And it's very funny because they actually mirror human behavior. They kind of get a little buzzy and happy at first, and then they start to lose motor coordination and stumble around. They start hitting on members of their same sex without realizing it, you know? And finally they get to that point where the pavement just looks really, really comfortable and they lie down and go to sleep. I'm not making this up. I watch them. They do this. But they're not us. They're fruit flies. There's another man, Nicholas Graham, who is studying binge-drinking mice. He does the opposite of what she does. She knocks out one gene at a time. He does it the old-fashioned way. He just breeds batches of them, selects the ones that like the alcohol the most, breeds them again, and does this through subsequent generations. He doesn't actually know which genes he's targeting, but he has a control group, and then he compares and contrasts. He has actually genetically engineered the most stone-cold binge drinkers. They will beat any frat boy. They can drink like four times. They can drink like an entire 3 gallons of wine in a day. They do not perform well on the little balance beam when he puts them on it. They lose their motor coordination. These give us hints, of course. These are animal models. They're not human models. But they do give us hints, and it turns out there is at least a couple of areas where this comes into play. There's a gene that influences your GABA receptors. GABA is a neurotransmitter or a chemical, a neurochemical, and it actually helps alleviate stress and anxiety. So people do occasionally self-medicate, you know, with alcohol. They feel anxious, they feel stressed, they take a drink, they calm down. The problem is if you keep doing that over and over again, you increase the number of dopamine receptors, and then you need more and more. and it just becomes this vicious circle. The other factor that is at play is a dopamine D2 receptor gene. Dopamine is, of course, the pleasure chemical. People respond differently to alcohol. I get very sluggish and sleepy. I do not have the right version of that gene. Someone else who has a different version of that gene is going to feel happy and elevated, and his spirits are going to lift, or her spirits are going to lift. And that's going to make them want to drink more. If I just drink and fall asleep, it's not very exciting for me, and I'm never going to be able to get around to drinking enough to really become an alcoholic. And invariably, there's going to be others. These are just the two most common that we've managed to identify right now.
Jennifer Ouellette, the author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She spoke at Town Hall on February 25th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to KUOW.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Jennifer Ouellette in a moment. 937 94.9 KUOW. Neuroscientist Scott Weems says there's much more to humor and laughing than joy. Hear him talk about his book, Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour tomorrow afternoon. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 30s. Partly cloudy, isolated showers this evening. Friday highs near 50, mostly sunny. The sound of singer-songwriter Rumor is described as a mix of the styles of 70s singer-songwriters, Broadway, 30s jazz, and gospel. Hear Rumor talk with Michael Feinstein about Judy Garland, Burt Bacharach, and Old Hollywood, and perform a set of songs. That will be beginning in just a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller with 9 locations that offer thousands of new and used titles, Husky gear, and gift items. Learn more about upcoming author events and store locations at ubookstore.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Jennifer Ouellette is a popular science writer and author of the Scientific American blog, Cocktail Party Physics. Her most recent book is called Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She spoke at Town Hall on February 25th, 2014.
William James defined the self as the sum total of all that a man can call his body, his psychic powers, his clothes, his wife and kids, his ancestors, his friends, reputation, his works, lands and horses, yachts and bank accounts. He's clearly a member of the 1%. But what is the core self? Psychologists refer to this thing called the militant I, and it's that thing that persists in all of us. You know, our personalities may change, our behaviors may change and alter. We may be able to expand our definition of the self into the virtual realm. If a blind man, his cane becomes a part of his body map and extends his self that way. The self is very flexible and malleable in that regard. But there is something at that core, and what is it? So I was talking about this with a friend of mine, with some friends of ours over dinner. One of them was a child of the Woodstock generation, shall we say. And he said, well, if you're interested in these questions of, you know, identity and the core self, you really need to try acid. And I went, oh, you would say that, you hippie. You know, it's like, and he says, no, let me tell you about this. He goes, because the ego disappears. And if you want to experience what the universe is like without your ego, without that I, you want to try this. He says, but I got to warn you, you know, it's not for everybody. He goes, because sooner or later you're going to come down and the self is going to come rushing back. He goes, and you'd better like what you see. So, you know, I do not ever do drugs. I don't even smoke pot. I hate inhaling smoke in my lungs. I don't like sticking needles in my arms for anything other than medical purposes. And I don't like snorting things up my nose. And that rules out most drugs. So a glass of wine with dinner is really about it. And a nice cocktail. But I did it. We actually planned an experiment. We had to go through this real elaborate setup because it turned, you know, I don't know where to get acid. But we ended up designing this weekend. We had very good advice. We had a medical person on call just in case. We did not need them. And we made sure to control the environment because it turns out that's very important. You know, you're basically, it's very subjective, and you're going to have the kind of experience that you set yourself up for. So it turns out that when I am on acid, I become that person at the party. I'll show you the next slide. There, literally, I would just spend the whole time going, wow. Because I would put my hand on like the granite countertop, and it would melt into it, and the patterns would crawl up my hands. Just fascinating. And so I'm kind of inquisitive, so I would just go around to all the objects in the house and touch it and see what happened. I also tried to take notes. That was impossible. That's it. That's all I managed. I did better than Albert Hoffman. He barely managed like three sentences. And you can see, I mean, molecules, man. I keep going on about molecules. Boundaries fade. Every object is a living, breathing thing. And then I finally realized how stupid I sounded. And I went, oh, God, I sound like every stoner acid head ever. So this is me contemplating a plank of wood. It really is just me. There's no sound. You don't really need to see it. It's the most boring video footage ever. I look up, and I just go right back down. And I'm going to do that for 5 solid minutes. And it looks like nothing. It looks ridiculous. But, of course, what's going on in my head is something very, very different. And that is what is interesting about LSD when it comes to how it works in the brain, is it actually really does have an amazing impact. It does change how you perceive the world. Aldous Huxley had this notion that LSD was like a counter to what he called a reducing valve in the brain. His idea was that what the brain does is put constraints on our experience. And LSD kind of interferes with that, so we start to experience way more than we normally do. Albert Hoffman, who discovered LSD, kind of referred to it as something that kind of biochemically alters the brain's receiver and tunes it to a different wavelength. A neuroscientist that I interviewed called it like a chemical lens. In the same way that if you look at the night sky with an optical telescope or an X-ray telescope or a gamma-ray telescope, you're going to see something a little bit different. It's still the same sky, but you're going to see things under each of those, through each of those filters that you wouldn't otherwise see. That's kind of what psychedelics do. Turns out they were right. In 2012, British scientists were actually able to get funding to do an experiment with people on magic mushrooms, psilocybin. It's a psychedelic that's very similar to LSD, and found out that they're literally mind expanding. There actually is less activity in the brain when you are on a psychedelic than when you're not. So the brain really, you know, it really is reducing how much the brain is constraining your perceptions. It was a fascinating study. They're now actually expanding that to look at acid and some of the others. I actually have a whole talk on psychedelics alone because it's a fascinating topic, and they actually do have some very good therapeutic potential medical benefits, including treatments for Parkinson's. So this is definitely an area that you're going to see more and more of genuine, bona fide, legitimate scientific research into these substances. They have been maligned a little bit too much. It does mess with your boundaries. I was talking about the brain. There are aspects of the brain that are involved with our sense of self. We have body maps, for instance. Some of you are familiar with the homunculi. It's basically a map of sensory and motor cortexes. And the reason the hands and the head and things are so big is because those areas that are most sensitive with the most nerve connections are the most important. So those are the ones that are represented larger on that. It's how your body knows where everything is. It's how it distinguishes between self and other. There's also the medial prefrontal cortex, which is where we process facial recognition. Those schemas that I talked about and that we build for people, that seems to be happening right in there. LSD messes with that boundary between self and other. You really do feel like you're kind of floating. You're disembodied and you're kind of floating. Your molecules are kind of out there and mingling with all the other molecules. I know I'm going on about molecules, but it's really what it's like. It dissolves the boundaries of the self. That is the shocking and revelatory thing that people experience with psychedelics. We have this unconscious feeling that we have always been who we are, and we don't realize that we are a construct. It can feel as if there is confusion about where we end and the world begins, as if we kind of merge with the world. And I just want to say that Cary Grant, long before me, talked about molecules. He actually, they were used for therapy, and his therapist was using it with him, and He got the molecules. So the self, you know, we don't really think of ourself as a construct. It feels very, very real to us. Many of you might have heard the self as an illusion. I don't like that term because illusion implies that it's something false. As I'm going to show you when we talk about consciousness and what this I actually is, you know, it may be a construct. It may be something that emerges and comes out of brain activity, but it is in fact a very real thing. Even under LSD's influence, there is still an I. So what does it mean to be conscious? The brain is a network of networks, and it has what's known as a small world structure. I'm not going to go into great detail about this, but just think of the airline hub network. You have a few central hubs: Chicago, O'Hare, Denver, Dallas, Atlanta, New York, LA, and then you have a lot of smaller airports throughout the region, and that makes it much more efficient to get from across long distances, because if you wanted to go from Seattle to New York and you had to only take local connections, it would take you 12 flights. This way you just fly to one central hub and then you kind of get dispersed from there. The brain and other small world networks, the electrical grid, they all act this way. It is nature really likes this because it's efficient, it's robust, it's really a good way to get information around. That's what the brain does. Each part of the brain might have a specialty. It processes like sensory information. But all that information has to be integrated or it's useless. So it has to transfer it to the bigger part of the brain, the processing part of the brain. And that's where all these small world networks come in. It turns out that under anesthesia, this network gets disrupted. They've actually done studies with patients under anesthesia, and they found that when they measured their brain activity, they were still receiving sensory input. The individual regions were still processing it, but it wasn't. It's like someone had shut down the connection to the hub, and it wasn't going anywhere. It was just kind of staying local. So when you lose consciousness under anesthesia, and when you faint or a deep dreamless sleep, that's what's going on. Are we getting close? All right. I'm going to try and whip through this because we got like 3 minutes. There's a reason that this happens. Consciousness, it turns out, comes out of, again, all those little neurons. Remember we talked about the synaptic self and how all those little neurons interact and all those connections. All that brain activity somehow produces an emergent property. How many people are familiar with emergence in complex systems? You are. You're a scientist, aren't you? In a nutshell, it basically is when the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. If you think of, say, a big block of gold, gold is a collection of atoms, and it has a property. It has a characteristic of, say, heat or hardness or brittleness, or it has a temperature, it has a pressure, all these things. Those properties actually are not inherent in the atoms themselves. It's something that kind of emerges when they all come together and start interacting, and then all of a sudden this property comes out of it. And that's kind of what consciousness seems to be. The way Christof Koch, the neuroscientist here at UW, put it, he goes, no matter, no mind. If there is no matter, my mind does not exist. And he and a guy named Tononi are actually working on a way to quantify this. Consciousness is actually a kind of integrated information. And how rich that integration is determines how self-aware we are. It determines how rich your self-representation is. It's why we are far more complex than a chimpanzee or a fruit fly or a nematode. I'm almost done here. But of course, consciousness is not merely wakefulness. You really do need to, about all that neuroscience has managed to do, like I said, it's a baby field, they've looked at basic wakefulness and self-awareness. What happens when we lose consciousness under anesthesia? How we wake back up, how our self, our identity kind of pieces itself together. We wake up from anesthesia in stages. You wake up from a deep sleep in stages, right? You slowly start to become aware of your surroundings and then your body and then your memories and all these things come back. We've all had that sensation of waking up and not for a minute knowing where we were. And that's because your brain is putting everything back together after being, you know, after that loss of consciousness. We do not know how these mechanisms produce a distinct, persistent, and subjective personal identity. It's called the hard problem of consciousness. This man, David Chalmers, coined that phrase. It's why I have a big question mark on the cover of my book, because this is an area where we really don't know. I really wanted to focus in my book on the science of self, what we can actually say in terms of, you know, peer-reviewed research and, you know, solid scientific data. Beyond this, we have some good ideas, but we actually really don't know. Memory might play a role, but it certainly isn't going to be central. There are plenty of patients who have lost their long or short-term memories, but they still have an eye, so clearly it's not central to that subjective personal identity. But it really is still very much a great mystery. So how do we make sense of this great mystery? Memories are important for one thing, autobiographical memories. They're very useful in helping us figure out who we are. So as an English major, whoops, that is me, my timer telling me that it is done. All right, I'm going to wrap this up very quickly. I'm an English major, so I love stories. And it turns out that we do have an autobiographical self. We are the stories that we tell about ourselves. And everybody does this. There's a man out at Northwestern. His name is Don. Don something. I'm drawing a blank on it. It'll come back to me. But he basically, what he does is he looks at people's stories, the narratives that they construct about their lives. And he does these long interviews. He's done it for hundreds of people from all walks of life, all ages, all races, all of us. We think of, you know, he has them sit down and think of themselves as their main character. He has them remember a past event, a pivotal event, you know, a really important moment, a painful, shameful moment. What are the themes of their life? Who were the heroes? Who were the villains? He has them construct a story. And it turns out that we all do this. We construct a story about who we are. This gets back to the very beginning when I said I constructed a story early on that I was an English major who was bad at math and that really influenced my decisions. That's very much what we all do. And so I think that I would leave you with this. The stories that we choose to tell are what give our lives meaning. I mean, if we look at, you can scan my DNA, you can scan my brain, you can break down all my atoms in my body down to the fundamental particles and map each and every one, position and velocity. You can do all of this. All of that is very, very insightful. You know, it can be useful to go down to that level, but it doesn't mean anything in its raw form without an interpretive layer. Think of this picture. This is a lovely picture, but at its heart, it's a bunch of little pixels. It's zeros and ones. Those zeros and ones, if we just looked at those, would be meaningless. We need that interpretive layer. And that's what the stories that we tell about ourselves are. They're a kind of mythos. You know, we create this myth about who we are, and it can be based on fact. It usually is. Memories are notoriously reliable. But it is what gives our life meaning. We get to choose what story we tell. And that's why, in my last line of the book is, if you really want to know who I am, let me tell you a story. So... And now I'm delighted to have questions. I'm sure you have many.
Oh, please excuse my laryngitis. I have a little bit of laryngitis.
I'm sympathetic.
I'm fascinated by these emergent properties. Could you spend a minute describing some good examples of emergence?
Sure.
And its ramifications.
Right. Emergent systems are pretty much everywhere. It's when you have a lot of little components. A traffic jam, for example, is an emergent property. You have a lot of cars, these little individual elements, and they're all interacting with each other in very, very complicated ways, extremely unpredictable ways. It's very difficult to predict how they're going to and map how they're all going to interact. And what happens is occasionally you get these, you know, if it gets dense enough, if there are enough interactions, you get this emergent thing, the jam. It all jams up and it changes its state. That's an emergent property. Consciousness is a little bit like that. What happens is you get all these neurons talking to each other. And if you get enough of those long-term connections, remember I was talking about the small world network, if it's just happening locally, you're probably not going to get that emergent property. But once it all starts acting together and integrating, you get all those interactions, you get enough of those, you hit a threshold, and suddenly consciousness, this property of consciousness, emerges. I use the gold example as well. It's everywhere. It's a very hot topic. It's used to study swarm behavior, bird flocking, things like that. All of these elements, things that have lots of little elements that all interact with each other, and in the process of that, they end up producing something that is greater than the sum of their parts. Hi.
I was thinking that we have so many demands on us these days between raising a family and work, being stuck in traffic, cell phones. so many things distract us. Do you think that those things inhibit our ability to learn more about ourselves because we're in constant response mode rather than reflection mode and learning more about who we are?
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I'm very active online, and obviously everything you do is going to change your brain in some way. I mean, every experience, you know, that there's synapses firing and wiring and all these things. Everything you do hardwires your brain all the time, rewires your brain all the time. You might give something up and gain something. You know, you might be able to, you know, I don't think it necessarily is a bad thing. I think that, you know, as we saw with the online avatars and the Facebook and things like that, you actually can, you know, use those tools to explore who you are. One of the ways, in fact, that I didn't really talk about that we develop our sense of who we are, we get feedback from people. People will tell us, oh, you're so this, you're so that, you know, oh, you're always like that, you always, you're very neat and organized, and it becomes part of our sense of who we are. And if their version of us doesn't meet what we think, it makes us very uncomfortable, and we will either change to become more like who they think we are, or we're going to try and get them to see us the way we want them to see us. And the online tools really do help with that. They really can be an extension of self. I also talked a little bit about the avatars. One of the things that's going to be very interesting, I think, going forward, it turns out that our psychological connection with our avatars are very, very powerful. Like, it can influence our behavior for better or for worse. So in that sense, I think you're right. At Stanford, Jeremy Balanson has been practicing with avatars. He's got people with their avatars that are exercising, and as they exercise and eat right, their avatar loses weight. They'll watch that for 20 minutes, and it will positively impact their eating and exercise behavior in the real world. And that effect will last for 2 weeks. You can change someone's perspective of themselves. Jared Lanier is back in, I think, he was one of the virtual reality pioneers. We have all these haptic feedback devices. And he wanted to see just how far he could push the bodily representation online. So he created a virtual lobster with all these extra limbs. And he only has two arms and two legs. How is he going to figure out how to move those extra limbs? Could his brain adapt? And the answer is yes. It turned out he could figure out micro movements in his fingers and hands and things like that, and he could use that to work the extra limbs. His brain figured out how to do it. And he's actually now working. That actually is going to be the next thing. You know, we now have Wii games where you can do this, and your avatar on screen does that, and you're connecting even more. At some point, you are really going to bond to this to the extent that, you know, it can actually be a physical representation of you in there, in the virtual realm. Your physical body will actually bond with your avatar, not just your brain. That's how powerful this stuff is. And again, it can be used for good or ill. Yes, you can use it to distract yourself and maybe get more ADD, but almost anything in life is like that. TV can be like that. You know, reading magazines instead of books can be like that. So it really depends on what you do with it. The tool itself is not evil. It's what you do with it.
Jennifer Ouellette, the author of Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. She spoke at Town Hall on February 25th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Swedish, announcing the opening of their health insurance information desk for those who have questions about which new health plans in Washington include Swedish in their provider networks. More information at swedish.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Sound Credit Union, where every member is also an owner. Sound has 21 full-service branches from Olympia to Linwood, all staffed with real human tellers. More at soundcu.com. Sound Credit Union. We never forget it's your money.
959 and change, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Tomorrow evening on Radiolab, a look at the pull of pop music. Some songs have the power to stick mercilessly in our minds. Some have the allure to dissolve cultural differences. We'll get a look at how songwriters create these songs seemingly out of the ether. We'll be listening in on the music a deaf man hears and an examination of the timeless appeal of the Elvis of Afghanistan. Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.